What I plan to do today is to discuss something about the kind of work that many people have been doing in analyzing DNA sequences. Sort of part of the involvement of this goes back more than 10 or 15 years, when a variety of people started looking at correlations in DNA sequences. And this was sort of, there were various aspects to it, but I'd like to talk a little about the general business of looking for correlations in DNA sequences and what it is that one can hope to find out. Okay. What I mean is really something very, very simple. We want to look at a correlation function like this, where S is some kind of an indicator function, which says that S is 1 if the nucleotide at position J is nucleotide type alpha. All right? And so typically people have been looking at a correlation function like this, normalized usually, and the average is typically taken over the entire DNA sequence of interest. Now, some of the truisms of the last few days, I will not repeat. The amount of information is exploding, and you get all sorts of stuff, et cetera, et cetera. Okay, all right. There are two foci of interest, so to speak. One is the region of large K, and the one is the region of small K. When K is small, that is to say when you look at short-range correlations, and typically K we are looking at is between 1 to 100. What is it that one looks at? What is the small-scale structure of the genome like? The small-scale structure of the genome has in it largely genes. We have introns. And one thing which so far nobody has really spoken much about, but repeats. Okay, regions, repetitive DNA, which is very frequently a marker for disease and stuff like that. All right, so the small scale structure of the genome really has this thing built into it, which is that you find the coding and the non-coding region, perhaps you find the repeats, perhaps you have the intron, exons, boundaries, etc. And what I would like to tell you about is some work that I've been doing in the last few years, which is to use the Fourier transform to look at short-range correlations. Now, on the large scale, what can one look at? And now, again, the information is there. You've got a whole chromosome or a whole genome, right? When you take human chromosome 22, we're talking about 33 megabase of information, all of which belongs to one organizational unit. Okay, that's about the largest that we have right now. All right. So, on the large scale, what does one see? It's a little like looking at the universe. When you look on the largest scale, there seem to be some really gross correlation between major features, and I'm going to show you some data. Major features, what are the large? It's a lot like looking at the universe. There are large regions where there are genes, and where there are genes, there's also other things. And then there are huge stretches of nothing, right? Relatively speaking. Okay, so, and correlations are a nice way, or this looking at the simple correlation function sometimes is just a very nice way of seeing some of these interrelationships. All right. First, I'll tell you what I'm not going to talk about, and what I will not talk about largely, although I'll just summarize some of the work that people like Stanley and company have been doing. Many people have done this, these kinds of analyses. Starts back Wentian Lee, who is now at Rockefeller. He was among the first to discover 1 over F noise. I'm going to show you some of his data and so on and so forth. But basically, the idea in the DNA walks is to go from a DNA sequence to some kind of a walk, okay, a representation of this DNA sequence, right? So if the base at position I is a purine, you step upwards, and if it's a pyrimidine, you step down or the other way, or any other coding is also possible. But basically, this is a way of looking at some kind of inhomogeneity in the DNA sequence. So if there's a lot of purines coming one after the other, then the walk will drift one side or the other side, and so on. All right. And what they do typically is to generate a DNA, generate this walk, and basically see how this walk deviates from the average. Okay. This is sort of the kind of thing one sees. This was done for chromosome 3 of yeast a long time ago, when this was the largest chromosome that was available. And this DNA walk, for example, you can see that it picks up certain kinds of features on the sequence, which is where the composition changes predominantly from being of one kind to being of another kind, right? And what in various works, and I'm really doing an injustice to all their point of view, but typically what they discovered was that if the walk was going through non-coding regions, if the DNA sequence was non-coding, then this DNA walk had this deviation from the average walk had an exponent which was roughly 1/2 if it was coding, and roughly 1 if it was non-coding. Right? So, I'm sorry, this is not the best thing, best exposition of their work, but this is more or less the kind of result that you get, that coding regions are, by and large, they have an exponent very close to the random walk, so it looks like a random walk, random structure, whereas non-coding regions have a certain long-range correlation in it. So their basic hypothesis or basic model, let's say, of DNA is that non-coding regions can be found out by the fact that they have a significant long-range correlation. And coding regions are found out by not having a significant long-range correlation. Yeah?
That's the way you determine that nearly the one is the random walk. Nearly the one has a
significant. Is it the
F squared?
F squared? Oh, F squared should go as. Okay. But that is really long range correlations are there in the non coding region. I must have meant two new ones. Yeah.
For new one, don't you mean correlations, or you mean it's an excess of one type over here?
True. I mean this is a controversial area, Mehran. This is, like I said, I'm really not doing justice to them, but I want to tell you that this is not to me where the problem is interesting. Right? The problem is that if you want to find genes, it's in the short-range structure of the genome that one is interested. And in order to do that, basically, what I'm going to try to look at is the small-scale structure. In order to do that, I'm going to compute the Fourier transform or the power spectrum of a DNA sequence. And that's the definition that I will use. There are many ways in which one could define it, but this is a simple one, which is the following. Again, I have this indicator function. So I've converted the DNA sequence into a string of ones and zeros symbols. And I take discrete Fourier transform, square it, and sum over all the symbols to get the spectrum. Right. If you do it on the largest scale, that is, if you do it for the whole chromosome, and this is straight from Wenti and Lee, this is his data, what you see is some kind of 1 over F behavior. This is for chromosome 4 of yeast. And this is done with larger and larger samples, right? So you see some kind of 1 over F structure, which is what he... he was taking different window sizes. So, you know, you take, chop it up into 2048 long, average over it or something like that.
This is
the whole chromosome. Whole chromosome. So the whole chromosome has some kind of gross 1 over F feature. Beg pardon? He was just trying to see whether or not it was just a small, it's, you know, it's a case of a small window or the whole thing. This was done in 96 when chromosome 4 was just becoming available.
So this is just one sequence?
Just that one chromosome.
No, not average.
Not averaged over them. Okay, that's why the noise is there.
Yeah.
Yeah? On the other hand, if you take smaller regions, and let me put both these up to show you. The noise goes away.
Does it go away in an interesting way?
No. 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 All right. Now, but when you go now to the gene level, right, this is the spectrum of a gene, and this is a spectrum of something which is not known to be a coding region. All right? And so, and here now the frequency is just going from 0 to 1/2, so I'm really now looking at small scale structure. Right? This is what I think Mark Borodovsky was also pointing to this morning, where this on the shortest scales you have some structure. And here you have a very sharp peak at frequency 1/3. Okay? Big one? The 2π was inside, yeah. So this is just good. I'm going to try to use this Fourier transform not to just find 1/3 correlation, but also to do repeats and stuff like that. Okay? Okay? So now the point is that this is there, nice and sharp, and it rises out of the background. And if you take almost any non-coding sequence, this is what it looks like for the non-coding sequence. Right? So, yeah.
And I'm just wondering what to evaluate, what should we evaluate, what should we
not do. No, I'll show you what is significant. I mean, what I'm going to do, one of the slides I have. Okay. Well, one thing one could ask is, does it come from all the various nucleotides? And the answer is that it doesn't. Because if I take a sequence and you know, split it up into 4 signals, Fourier transform for A looks like this. Well, for T it's up there, and G it's up there, and A and C it's absent. So it's there in the whole sequence, not in necessarily in any particular subsequence. All right. Now, okay.
So this is just the code and use it, right? I mean, why?
Right. See, A, in this particular example, it turns out that the ways in which the codons are used, A did not have this 3-base correlation, whereas it was there in T and G. Mm. Right? For other genes, it could be some other way.
You're within one single gene.
You're within one single gene.
I mean, you can't have A without G.
Yeah, sure. Right? No. All right. So, but the point is that if you did the overall Fourier transform, that's what you would get almost always.
I mean, when I compare this with this morning's talk about gene time, this is such a clear signal.
Yeah.
Isn't this enough to find?
It turns out it's not nearly enough. All right. But I'll try to tell you what are the limitations of it. All right. Okay. So. Yes.
So it was only coding and nothing else. Suppose you had a bit of non-coding.
I'm going to show you the results. Right. Okay. So the measure that we sort of proposed that we could use was the following. That is, look at the power at frequency 1/3 divided by the average power, and then we did a normalization because different windows have different amounts of power, so you normalize it to unit power, and we call this the measure a coding measure. Right. This is one coding measure. There are many others that one could use. But part of the rationale for using something like this was that it had a certain kind of discriminating power. Okay? That is to say, if you took 1,000 genes or so, and you asked what is the length of the gene versus this peak to noise ratio at frequency 1/3. Well, I mean, they all sort of clustered a little around that. So the point is that it's far away from one. So it's clearly something that's rising out of the noise, and it's something that you can see. Right? Okay. You can do better than that. And basically what one does is to ask, what's the distribution? Okay. What is the distribution of this particular measure over coding stretches versus the distribution of the measure over non-coding stretches? And this is the integrated distributions. All right. So for all coding stretches, the signal is really higher than the ordinate. For non-coding stretches, the signal is lower than the ordinate. And the way in which I originally did it, I'd probably do it different gumball-wise now. But okay, so you know, almost all the non-coding stretches will have signal-to-noise ratio less than this number. Almost all of them will have, the coding ones will be higher than this number. So it becomes possible, therefore, to put your discriminator over there and say, if my signal to noise ratio is higher, it's likely to be coding. If it's lower, it's likely to be non-coding. Right? In some sense, this is what many gene finding algorithms do. Right? But what the point that I'm trying to make here is that if you take a measure, measure whatever it is, I've called it P, all the coding regions are there, all the non-coding regions are there, it's wonderful. But in practice, actually, it never quite turns out that way. In practice, it turns out that one goes in and the other goes in like so. So what you would like to find is the point which is the minimizes errors. Okay, and this is empirical. Yeah? So this number that we chose happened to be something like 4. So the idea is that if you find your signal-to-noise ratio, that which is measuring your correlation function, if you find it higher than 4, it's coding. If it's lower than 4, it's non-coding.
This measure is not working. What minimum size window do you have to do that?
You can actually start with windows of the size of 50. Yeah. It's a practical question, UI, in the sense that, you know, one just finds that the noise sometimes, for small windows, the noise gets so large that you're not able to say anything with certainty. I'll just show you some, you know, sort of typical data.
That means this method would be sort of probably poor to get exactly the beginning of the gene.
Yeah. Okay, so because I know that Ralph is...
you can ask a question.
No, of course I'm going to. All right, so this is a method that that we then encapsulated, and we call this algorithm gene scan. It has an extra E compared to the... you can figure out which one was an insertion or a deletion later on. All right. So the idea is, again, in part, this is also to tell a little about how almost every gene finding method works. You do typically have sliding windows, although, as Mark pointed out this morning, you can go away from that. And there's a reason why one is sticking with the simple. Right? One is sticking with the simple because what we have found by examining genes from all sorts of organisms is that this is as universal a property as you can find. Whether it is eukaryotics, prokaryotic, archaea, fungi, the works, bacteria, everybody has this particular signal. And you can go very far with it. And in that sense, it's sometimes useful because you're putting in very little other kind of, no other model. The practical reason why I came around to doing it is also that how I got into it. I'm sorry not to bother you with history, but I got into it because a colleague of mine works on a parasite called Entamoeba histolytica, which is totally unimportant over here, but it's very important in India. And this parasite has an extremely high 80-rich genome. It has a very unusual codon usage, and almost every gene that you send for information to BLAST okay, at least in 95, 96, would come back with unknown, unknown, unknowable, because there was no other such parasites in the database. Okay, today the situation may be different, but that's how we got into it. So if you want to stick with the minimal model, that's the point I want to make, all right? That you these genes are atypical for us at that time. Okay. So what you do in this procedure is you take a window of m bases, compute the signal-to-noise ratio in that particular window, slide that along, and we've chosen a discriminator in our procedure. It happened to be a number 4, but you put your discriminator. If it crosses, you have a gene. Okay, and that's how it works. Right? This is for yeast, which is an easy example. All right? It works for a lot of easy examples, I should point out. Okay? I'll tell you where it doesn't work. But this is the signal-to-noise ratio in a window. As I'm sliding along the chromosome from 260 onwards at some position, and this is how that thing changes. Here's my discriminator threshold. And on top over here, I've put the standard annotation. Right? So you can see there's almost a sort of a perfect match between what is presumed to be a gene and how the signal goes up and down. So in answer to your question, Nigel, what happens if you are straddling a coding and non-coding region? You can tell, you can actually tell the boundary quite well. Right? And you can even tell difficult cases, like, you know, when there's just a very few number going in between. Right? The signal actually dips substantially. Right? Now this is a you know, this now becomes an engineering game. Because you've got yourself this discriminator, you've got a window, you experience a little with what kind of windows you choose and so on. But then some of the other knowledge that one has about gene structure, you put it into this. Very close to the boundary of the coding region, there should be an ATG. On the other side, there should be a TAA. And when you do this, with this simple method for, and now this is, of course, a lower eukaryote, this is yeast, but with this simple method, you can find close to 90% of all the genes.
If yeah? You can find genes also the copies of the genes.
Yeah. Yeah, you can find pseudogenes, you can find
genes. You can find genes and the copy of the genes of the opposite spread on the
DNA. The shadow, you can... Okay, by purely this Fourier method, all that you really find is, you know, you find a signal like this. The engineering goes into finding some of the other parts of it, finding the starting and the stopping, finding out whether it's on the start, on the sense strand or the anti-sense strand. What we were able to do for an example like this was to find essentially something like 90% without too much difficulty.
My question is much simpler. You find genes or also
shadows? We only find genes. Only find coding regions.
Because the opposite strand is copy, direct copy of the first one. So you must get the same correlation in both gene and shadow.
True. Okay, maybe I should state it again. What we find is coding regions or coding potential, which we classify in this particular way. Then the algorithm goes and looks for a start, looks for a stop, and has a model. Okay? For genes with introns, yeah, the spectrum is identical on both strands, so you don't find. No, not in the Fourier transform. It's identical because it's just looking at the symbols. All right. This is a case of a globin which has got 3 exons, all right, and 2 introns, and here you can see that. You know, a simple method like this cannot really find you the boundaries. All right? Because the boundaries of this are quite different from those of the exons. But even with this, you can see that there are 3 regions of exons, and a subsequent model which may involve either HMMs or anything else can be put onto this to find it. All right? Okay. Then One other thing that you can get out of looking at a correlation like structure like this is that you notice there are two genes which are side by side over here, you know, by CR86 and 87W. And even though this space separating them is a very small amount, this signal comes all the way down, right? Now, it is a hypothesis which we have been able to at least verify in a few cases, not in all, that when you see this kind of oscillation or the structure in bigger proteins, where the signal comes shooting down is usually a signal of a proto-domain. You know, where maybe a fusion event took place in order to give you a particular protein, okay? Where, for example, language might have changed or something, right? This is not, you know, true in every one of the cases, but, you know, this is the kind of a thing that we are looking at now, and we found some good examples, we also found some bad examples. So this is see, the question is that if you've got a very specialized protein with well-formed functional sites, right, and you evolved from some precursors, does that memory still remain somewhere within the DNA sequence? And there's some indication that it could. Yeah. You mean there's a frame shift? No. It's not just a case of frame shift. I mean, these are just two very different genes, and you just find that in between the correlation somehow just decayed. So I would, you know, there's a question this morning about if there's a different language being used, can one tell? And I don't know, but I can't assert with certainty, but I feel that simple methods like this do also have a potential for just looking at it. Okay, now I'm just going to show a few things that supposing you take the signals, the Fourier spectra of a whole lot of these, and average over them. There's a question as to what is the significance of some of the other So the peak at one third, of course, gets extremely sharp, but out of the noise comes up another peak, which is at 1/11 or 1/10.5. Okay, that's actually real. It can you know, goes along with the DNA turn. So if you just take a whole lot of, if you take all these spectra and average them, you take many genes, yeah. You take the Fourier transform for each one of them, average over all of them. All right? So the peak at one third is real. Almost no other feature is real except for this creature over here, which is a remnant of some structural feature. Okay. Now, just one last thing to show you that there is the large scale structure of the chromosome. Yeah, that counts the number of genes. Yeah.
Nothing
at all. Yeah, but you see, the DNA structure itself has somewhere that sort of constraint that makes that 11 come through. All right? No, that I wouldn't, because the structure of the model that you have is not very clear, right? This is only for pure known genes, not for exons and introns. Yeah? Okay.
So you run this over genes
only? Only genes.
You still see this
10, this thing?
What is it?
Yeah.
I'm just wondering,
you
were saying that the 1/11 peak, the word of how you coded it went on, but yeah.
I suspect this was just, this is almost like a gag, that what can the small scale structure of the genome tell you, right? Okay, finally, just to underscore the fact that the large scale structure of the genome is also important, you know, especially with view to the sort of correlations between many structures, there are three kinds of features that biologists look for on the genome. And this is for chromosome 22, human chromosome 22. Right? And what I've plotted over here is the density of genes in solid line over here. The density of something known as matrix attachment region or scaffolding regions, which is, seems to play a big role in how the chromosome attaches itself to various things. Right? I'm not very clear as to what it does, but it's a feature which people look at. And then there's repetitive regions which are known as ALUs or ALUs. Okay, and these are shown over here. Right? And this is over the entire chromosome, so that goes from 0 to something like 33 million bases. And what has been done is to count the number of features in a sliding window of length 2 million. Right? So you're looking at the Hubble and information from the Hubble on the entire chromosome. Shift here is 200,000. Right? And what you can see, and this is the, you know, I don't know what else to make of it except to show you that it's there, that the gene density varies quite substantially over the entire genome, over the entire chromosome. In fact, it reaches locations where it's only one or two. In a million, in a window of a million, right? There's only one or two genes. And okay, so it has some kind of an oscillatory structure over here. And it doesn't require too much or any further analysis to see that if you look at the ALUs, they also seem to go up where there are lots of genes, go down where there are no genes, and so on. And so more interestingly are the MAR regions. They have slightly more structure, but they also get correlated to a very high degree with where the genes are. Right? Now, okay, so one can look and examine this wider scale structure and ask exactly how are they correlated. Presumably, there is a common evolutionary history as to why the genes are there at various locations. So other stuff which is important also tends to be over there. Right? But anyhow, I just thought that I should give some kind of data. This is fairly recent stuff that we've been doing on the use of correlation methods, let's say, in looking at whole genome-wide analysis of DNA. Thanks. Nothing. Yeah, I mean, it's just sort of completely, the whole genome can be really very, very sparse.
Where is the center man?
Big man?
Where is the center of this chromosome?
I'm not actually sure, but I have some data somewhere which shows just how sparse the whole thing is. See, this is what, you know, in a half million stretch, I mean, the genes are, you know, somewhere over there. The ALUs are more, there are more of them, but actually they're more strongly correlated with the genes than they are with the MARs. And you can do that by looking at some cross-correlation functions and so on. Yeah?
So throughout the whole thing, the most important measure is just the
130. Yeah.
One
yeah.
On this slide, there is one before the last one.
Yeah. Oh, the peak at 10 or 11. Yeah. This one. Okay. The there was some work by Widom in a paper in Molecular Journal JMB a few years ago, where again he did some kind of a Fourier transform analysis and showed this, and he correlated this with the DNA turn, that the constraint imposed by the turn of the whole DNA, not just the double helix, that required a periodicity of about between 10 and 11. The explanation, as I understand it, is that it is a structural constraint that it must have in order to be able to turn in that particular way, and that shows up over here if you just look at this kind of a correlation function.
You mean the turn of the coil?
Yeah, the turn of the coil.
When it wraps around the crystal?
No, just the helix is a smaller turn, right? Yeah, it takes 10 bases to turn, not the histone turn, that is a much larger one. Yeah?
Why did you see the histone?
Oh, because these are, yeah. And you know, it may not come out of this. See, the other thing that we've been using these Fourier transforms for is to identify repeats. See, repeats are small segments, you know, maybe up to 15 or 20 bases long, and they are coming one after the other. And it's one of the easiest things to be able to pick out of a Fourier transform, that you've got a peak not at 1/3 but at 1/19, and there you've got a repeat of 19. Yeah.
When I compare this simple periodicity with the HMMs,
yeah.
It must be sort of. Do they take this into account in their emission frequency? I would think that given this result,
yeah,
it would be, of course, obvious to construct these emission frequencies out of triplets.
I don't know, I think Mark would probably, but presumably you use Hexmer information in order to construct the emission frequencies, right? Yeah, so not the triples, but the Hexmers, those are somehow more important. Whether this kind of information is used inside the hidden Markov models. Yeah. So they get used.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. In a sense, what one is doing over here is a completely minimalist model. I mean, no more information is put about coding potential than this primeval signature. And the point that I'm making is that with this alone, you can pick up essentially 90% of all coding regions. You don't pick up a significant number of certain kinds of genes. Right? There are some other constraints that go into the genes which we don't pick up. Right? Or sometimes the signal is really very, very noisy. You find it hidden away inside other signals and so on. But there is some merit to a method which has no other prior information. But whether the merit beyond that, the question is really what can correlations in DNA sequences tell you? And my contention is that they tell you a lot more on the small scale than they do in this other way of maybe exponents or long range or what have you.
Is there any information you can get out of using other transforms?
See, the wavelets, for example, which is what some people have tried, don't turn out to be the ideal ones to use for something like this, because gene structure is not hierarchical. I mean, there is no fractal nature to be probing over here, so wavelets turn out not to be it's overkill. You don't get anything more with wavelets than you would with a simple power spectrum. Codon.
Code.
Yeah.
So if you really strung in random amino acid and transfer back to, you know, randomly one of these three that correspond to it, you will still see the speed?
No.
So that means there is some other correlation.
True, absolutely. And the fact that all coding regions in all species have it seems to suggest that there is, of course, it comes from, you know, mathematically speaking, it comes from some kind of a triplet bias. Right, but there is a certain pattern that has been preserved. You know, that correlation structure has been preserved. So there is a little more to it than just, you know, taking the random codons and scrambling them around. You won't get the. Yeah, of course, that is the background, and that is what we can do, that background check to find out what to expect. So, you know, here, if you like, my my surprise is when it crosses 4, not when it crosses 3 or 2, but only when it crosses 4, then I know that it's significant.
Okay, if that's all the questions so far.
Yeah. The cross correlations. The cross correlations also have the same signature, but again, it's overkill. It's not really needed because they're not all independent information. They're all correlated somehow. So it's enough to take the self correlation. It turns out to be enough.
So basically, from my view,
you get out of this is 3. Yeah. This out of this, you get is 3, and 3 is there overwhelmingly. And if you just looked for it, you'd find almost 90%. For eukaryotes, it's a little more complicated, but still you can pick up almost every coding region. Boundaries and all is engineering.
Song,
yes.
But it doesn't work.
It doesn't, you don't hear it, it's just for recording. It's
recording. Oh, I see. That's the reason. Sorry, I didn't understand. So let me put this somehow. Okay. Well, within the 20 minutes allocated to me, I'll try just mention a few points with a different flavor compared to what we have heard in the last 2-3 weeks. Briefly, I'm going to mention a piece of finished, published work, the avoided underrepresented strings, short strings, in prokaryote complete genomes. It's published and have PDF files with me, so if anyone wants, just drop me a message. I can email you this. Then, a failed attempt to use this avoidance signature. So nothing written, nothing will be written. And then, from this failure, we learn something more. We try to build phylogenetic trees based on complete genomes, using so-called compositional distance. I'll say a few words more. Then, repeats in prokaryote genomes, the problem I'm working on. Well, the first piece, the question is quite simple. You take a complete genome, say E. coli, say loop with, say, that many nucleotides in this specific organism which has been sequenced. Made of 4 letters, no other letters at all, I ask a simple question. If I took length 7 and look at all possible strings, so there are that many of them, if this loop is a random sequence, I divide this, I got something like 280. So I expect, on average, each kind of string would appear 280 times. You have some distribution centered around this number. So I wrote a simple program using a small window of that width and slide it letter by letter. So you need only counters, that many counters. I put all these counters into a square. Just 2 to the k by 2 to the k. So each cell in this square counts for the number of strings of the specific type. Well, I must apologize to a few colleagues who have seen this picture before. I recognize some, the precursor here. So this is what you see in E. coli, for E. coli. The four corners, G, C, A, T, for length 8. For length 8, you divide this by 4, you get average 70. You see white dots. White dots are absent strings. There are 173 of them at this length. Well, this is just a snapshot. If you come to my office, I have this programming running. So you can, using your mouse, you just click and you see what kind of string, how many. Please. Well, I'm interested in the number of different kinds of strings. There may be so from zero to some quite big number. I don't have that many colors. So I use only 16 colors. It's a kind of cross-greening. I'm interested in these absent ones and underrepresented ones. So I allocate most of my bright colors to small counts. White color for none, so this red for 1, 2, 3. If counts bigger than 30 or 39, I just put a black dot there. So you see some kind of patterns. This pattern can be explained very simply. Oh, here you have 256 by 256 small cells, 65,000. Since you have 65,000 for length 8, you have that many different kind of strings. So I need that many counters. I just put them in the square. So you take this corner. This corner will count for string made of 8 consecutive G. And here, the 8 T. Or you can look at even this, let me find this, histogram. I don't know, does it look like an extreme value distribution? This is the largest count, 774 for length 8. When 70 is average for a random sequence, you have 11 times bigger than the average. And here, 0, you can see this small bin here, so 173, 0 ones, absent. Well, this only observation, you can, since I have this program running, I look at all possible, all these genomes I have. Yeah. So this is for, someone mentioned this. You see this kind of avoidance, quite regular structure. You can do further cross-greening, just take this picture, make a black-white. Xerox, this is also cross-green. You ignore all this small difference in numbers. And you can read out at least five different systems, different sets of patterns caused by the under-representation of strings containing this kind of palindromes. For string of length 4, you have 256 of them. But there are only 16 palindromes. All these 16 palindromes, all of them, are recognition size of some kind of restriction enzymes. So what we observe may be related to some stage in the ancient time, where in the primordial soup, the first restriction enzyme appeared.
So you have 8 letters, right?
Huh? 8 letters. Well, I can change this length from 7, 8, 9.
What about in the last?
Last picture 9, actually 9 picture. 9, length 9, I suppose. This one. You mean this one?
So now we need to color the square.
Now look at color ones. Yeah. This is for lens 9. So 512 by 512.
Yeah. Then each square should have how many coordinates?
Well, this is just allocation of counters. If you put them along a line, you can't comprehend. Yeah, please.
It looks from your figure, the figure, that the places of rarely sequences, they are grouped on your square.
Yes.
What?
Yes.
Yes. But it is just a matter of your chance that some points.
No, it's not due to a chance. This is just shows this non-randomness of this sequence. I took this.
Not random. I don't understand why it is the picture so coarsely drilled. It must be a different point. It looks like different points for different sequences. But I see groups of such points of low frequency and groups of such points of high frequency.
Yes.
Why?
I tell you why. Look at E. coli. In E. coli, apparently, there is only one group of sequences or strains which contain a short string CTAG. For some reason, E. coli doesn't like CTAG. This is my counting scheme. I always put all the counters into a big square for length 6, 7, 8, 9.
So then, what I was trying to ask, maybe if you explain a bit better how the axes are really defined. How the axes are really defined.
Well, let me write down the precise definition. Okay. Suppose you want to count number of nucleotide only. There are four of them, so I need four. So four counter. I allocate in this way. I call this a matrix. Then for string of length k, you need a matrix which is a direct product of eight such matrices. So this is direct product of that.
How to arrange in space? Suppose you have row number 5 and column number 8.
What is that? If you, at random, you take one, I can't tell you immediately. But after some reflection, I can tell you. At corners, that's very simple. Say this one, I can't tell you. Let me describe this.
The square is the remaining positions.
Well, this is all the counters for all strings of length 6, 7, 8, and 9. And then I mark those strings which contain these four letters, CTAG, consecutive. So you have this pattern.
Isn't it as if you now take that square divided in, each of those squares divided into four, and then it is G?
Yeah, you just divide this. You divide this for dinucleotide, you put the second in the same order, and then you divide further. This is direct, direct product. Yeah, you come to my office, I explain you this in detail about this direct product. So this one can be rid of easily. You just divide by 4, you see it's here. So this is my C, so the first letter must be C, and then you divide this by 4, this you get T in this lower corner, so the second letter is T. You go further, you can read it off. Actually, if you come to my office, you just click at any point, it will tell you what sequence, how many, and the count. Well, I will not continue with this because it's published.
If I see a big square there, that means that, for example, the third letter of these sequences are the same.
Well, here I can say all the strings, the short strings of length 9, which starts with 4 letters, CKAG, all the counters are concentrated here. Yeah. Yeah. Then you may have the first letter being G, and then you have 4 following letters, CKG, and the last 5 letters may be NA in these 4 dots.
So all strings with CKG as the last 4 letters are scattered everywhere?
Not everywhere. If you start with CKG, then all of them are located here. Not necessarily CTAG. For length K9, you might have some CTAG. So that's another problem. You may have some overlap. Well, once you know this, you can do some direct counting without looking at figures. Let me show you direct counting. I mentioned this number, 173 for E. coli. If I do direct counting, I can identify one missing string at length 7. And at next length, I have 173. However, among these numbers, 8 must be consequence of that, because a string of length 7 did not appear. You can add 4 letters at the end or in front. You get 8. Then you go to longer and longer ones. So I put these numbers. How did you get this number? There's very simple-minded estimate, like mean field theory. You ignore all possible overlaps. You get a formula as simple as this one. So for E. coli, you are 14-8, so you can take this formula, and in there you get all these numbers, up to 13. But this formula will not work for length for 13, because this first avoided string starts with G and ends with G. So you can continue, you write CCTAGG. You get a string which would be killed twice. The result is the same, the overlap. And this overlap also appears in the kind of picture. So this is a very simple picture which shows I mark only those strings which contain letter G. I call this G-tag strings. So all the strings starting with G, the second letter being G, there must be one second letter also being G, emerged there. This picture is quite regular. You can think about and calculate the fractal dimension, just logarithm 3 over logarithm 2. However, if you go to two-letter tag, like this one, let me show you. Well, this is the same kind of picture for a very short piece of human genome. That's the sequence which codes for human immunoglobulin light chain. About 1 million, a little bit longer than 1 million, including all these non-coding coding introns, and pass through this program, you get some kind of self-similar structure, and this has been known to biologists. Because in human genes, CG, we have much less CG than GC. If I mark in my frame all these GC or CG containing counters at length 9, I get this kind of picture. If you want to calculate dimension of that, you encounter a problem, this overlap problem. I show this overlap in different colors. So some strings might be killed twice or 3 times. So you should count them only once. Well, so far, I look at some pictures. I got 2 problems, mathematical problems, but now. How to calculate the dimension of this kind of tagged strings, and also how to count the number of strings which would be brought away by the shorter ones, since avoid the strings. Well, on a little more reflection, you see these two questions are one and the same, because this picture is also it's only this representation of that fact. Well, this mathematical problem has been solved exactly by using two different methods, combinatorics and language theory. I will not go into details. It's described in the file. So this is my first point. Then, I skip all this. We observe this signature. What kind of short strings, palindromes, a bacteria doesn't like? It's quite specific. We try to use this specificity to do some classification, phylogeny. First of all, you look at within one organism. So this guy we heard about, this one survived 1,000 times bigger radiation dosage. It has four chromosomes. There are two of them. These are the 16 palindromes. And these are collected from the first bunch of avoided strings. So this is not what you see in the genome. This is in the complementary set. What you don't see. If you have zeros here, this means this bacteria is indifferent to all these combinations. All these are present. However, they don't like, say, this TA and this one, like E. coli. This for one organism. You can compare this for different organisms. So here are four different bacteria. All these numbers normalized to 100. So E. coli doesn't like CKG. Some others also. But this one is indifferent to CKG. It doesn't like this GC combinations. But this is due to low GC content mainly. You see all this almost appear at the same frequency. Well, all attempt to use this kind of information failed. You cannot get good phylogenetic trees. Well, in order to get phylogenetic trees, good trees, you need some ingredients. Neutral selection, molecular clock, this we take for granted. And also, you need a very long vector to represent your species. These vectors are too short. So in this way, we went to so-called compositional distance. Well, the same idea. You take short strings of a fixed length k. You build a vector of all possible types, and you count them. Well, this time not avoided. Those which are present here, you get a vector. You normalize this. Actually, you apply this to the whole genome and also the collection of coding sequences. And also to the translated amino acid ACEs, sequences. The last one worked the best. Well, for length 5, you have 20 amino acids. You need a vector of length 3.2 million. So it worked with that kind of vectors. You build these vectors for each species. You take the angle, just cosine between them, this correlation. One minus correlation, you get some kind of distance. Actually, we tried to subtract also a random background and build phylogenetic trees. I'm writing the paper right now. Well, these kind of trees happen to be too good, very good for biologists. You know these two hypersomophilic bacteria made some trouble recently. caused a hot debate on lateral gene transfer. Actually, in Norway, all the archaea grouped here, and these two, they sit together, close to, but still distinguished, quite distinct from that group. Yeah. Okay, I think I don't have more time, so let me just say a few words about repeats. Well, for eukaryotes, there are many repeats for human genome, maybe 40% even more repeated sequences. There is at least one database, RepBase, for eukaryote repeats. This database has been used in a negative sense. It's mainly used for masking this repeated and the low complexity segments in your DNA sequence. So if you look at RepBase, actually the knowledge there is quite limited. You have a name, say Alu, you have a consensus, it didn't tell you how many copies in which organism. Generally, I was told by biologists there are very few repeats in prokaryotes. But if you look at this carefully, still you see many of them. For time being, we have collected all the short strings of length 15 in all the prokaryotes genomes, which appear in both strands at least twice, quite long list. You just think about this in the same spirit of random sequence. For bacteria, the length is the order of 1 million of the genome. If you consider length 15, there are 4 to the 15, 2 to the 30, so almost 10 to the 9 different kinds of strings, K-strings. So if it's random, you have this probability to get a particular one. Multiplied by the length, still you get something like 1,000 for a given string. If you see two strings appearing in the same genome, so already something quite far from random. Well, actually you see in some bacteria, you see 30 copies, even more, of sequence length 15. So there are different kinds of them. We use these short strings to fish out longer ones. So there are so many of them. For time being, we are working from the two extremes. For short strings, 15 or 18, but which appear many, many times. Or other kind, other extreme, you have only two copies, but very long strings. Well, just tell you one small observation. I hope I can find this. There are different kinds of them. There are tandem repeats, so they appear immediately. There are many so-called, well, not so-called, we call almost periodic. You have some period, say, around 60, 65 or so. You have the exact repeated segment, say, length 30. Then you have a tail. We cannot find any similarity within this tail. Even the length of tail vary a little bit. But all this may spread, you may get, say, 40 copies of that. There are many, many kind of, we are trying to collect all this, make classifications, and make a database of repeats. Just the last experiment, the last transparency. So a little bit reflection on randomness and determinism. You have a long sequence which of genome of some organism. It's not a random sequence for sure, but if you look at some characteristics, say random walk, you get some exponent, not 1/2, but close to 1/2. If you go to longer, these short strings, longer words, well, in the extreme, you look at stream that length, there is only one for this particular species, not species, organism. So you see a transition from randomness to determinism. Well, when we played with short repeats, we observed that this, how do you call this, oligonucleotide, 18, length 18, they appeared in these two as repeats which appeared, say, 10 more times. I sent this to BLastSearch in this EMBL and GenBank. And EMBL returned me another species, which also has this subsequence. No other organism so far has this 18 nucleotide in a row. So this might be a genus marker, if you like. So only this genus for the time being. So this is just one fact we encountered when playing with. Well, I'll say this for here for 5 more weeks. I have some program running. So if you are interested, you can come and see this. By the way, this random walk, you can look at 2-dimensional random walk. You put the 4 letters for 4 different directions, you see interesting pictures. Or not random walk, steering walking walk. You have only one realization for each genome. Thank you.